This is Marcus Sladen and Christina Leffring with your local news coming to you from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. And here are tonight's headlines.
Wisconsin's former revenue secretary will take on incumbent Brian Stile in November to represent the state's first congressional district. Peter Barca held the first district seat from 1993 to 1995, reports the Associated Press. He was elected to the state assembly in 2008, where he served until Governor Tony Evers appointed him in 2019 to run the Department of Revenue. Stile is running for his fourth term in Congress. He was elected after his predecessor, House Speaker Paul Ryan, declined to run for office.
An investigation into smuggling at Waupun Correctional Institution has led to the resignation or firing of five prison employees, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports. Six other employees remain on administrative leave in the wake of their federal probe, conducted at the request of Governor Tony Evers and the State Department of Corrections. No employees have been criminally charged, according to the Journal Sentinel. The prison has been on lockdown for a year, and in recent months was the site of several inmate deaths. A class action lawsuit has also been filed alleging cruel and unusual conditions at Waupun.
Seven University of Wisconsin system campuses face an impending financial crush, an independent financial consultant has concluded. Some students and faculty at the campuses argue that the crisis is based on politics rather than economics. The campuses at River Falls, Oshkosh, Whitewater, Parkside, Platteville, Green Bay, and Superior were advised by the consulting firm Deloitte to cut staff, and possibly whole academic programs, according to the UW-Madison's Daily Cardinal. System President Jay Rothman called on the state legislature to increase funding to the state's UW campuses. A 2023 report from the nonpartisan Wisconsin Policy Forum ranked Wisconsin 42nd in the nation for state funding of public universities.
A nonprofit group working to improve conditions for the homeless wants to use a Far East Side commercial property as a staging area to build tiny houses similar to those on its property on North 3rd Street. Occupy Madison currently has tiny houses for the homeless at two Near East Side sites. Former commercial buildings at both locations have been converted to provide showers, kitchens, and other resources for tiny house residents. A building on the Far East Side property at 205 South Stoughton Road would serve as a production shop for more tiny homes. The property also would serve as a location for a third tiny house community, the Wisconsin State Journal reports. The proposal will require rezoning from industrial light to tiny house village. As with its other housing projects, Occupy Madison is financing the project through private fundraising, as well as grants from the City of Madison and Dane County.
A pedestrian causeway along a reconstructed John Nolan Drive will be the centerpiece of a major redevelopment plan for the Lake Monona waterfront, according to the Wisconsin State Journal. Initial construction for the project is slated to begin next year, as outlined under the master plan the Madison City Council approved with discussion on Tuesday night. Reconstruction of the roadway is expected to take 2 years and cost $30 million. The community organization Friends of the Nolan Waterfront will spearhead fundraising efforts for the accompanying pedestrian facilities. So far, the city has earmarked $600,000 in 2024 and $6 million in 2026 toward construction of the pedestrian boardwalk, the State Journal reports. Along with the causeway, the plan calls for a staircase from Wilson Street to a lakeside amphitheater, a large dock in Olin Park, and a plaza over Nolan Drive at Monona Terrace.
Too strapped for cash to fix a broken taillight? Getting pulled over by UW-Madison police could be a welcome development. The department has joined with a group called Lights On, in a program that hands out vouchers redeemable for safety repairs instead of tickets. Lights On reimburses participating auto repair shops that accept the vouchers for fix-up costs, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. The organization has distributed more than 100,000 vouchers in 21 states. So far, UW police have recruited one repair shop, Lynch Auto Body on Atwood Avenue as a participant in the program.
Opportunities for late-night snacking have returned to the Library Mall at State Street. The expanded night vending program now runs Wednesday through Saturday from 8 p.m. to 2:30 a.m., with up to 5 vendors allowed. The first participating vendors Wednesday night were Sabro Quarantano, Marimar on Wheels, Jakarta Barbecue Station, Bit of Brianna, and Thailand in a Truck. Those were the headlines, and now, on to the rest of today's top stories.
This is bull, Governor Evers said last year. That's after the legislature's Budget Writing Committee held up pay raises for state employees, though the governor and the full legislature had already given their stamp of approval. Evers filed a lawsuit in October against the committee's co-chairs, arguing that the laws gave them veto powers are unconstitutional. The state Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the lawsuit yesterday. WORT reporter David Ahrens has more.
Yesterday, the state Supreme Court heard oral arguments on a dispute over the separation of powers between the Wisconsin's executive and legislative branch, specifically between Democratic Governor Evers and the Republican-controlled Joint Finance Committee. This dispute has recently come up a lot. Last year, 5 members of the committee held up funding to purchase a 70,000-acre conservation tract at Pelican River Forest. The land was slated to be purchased with funds appropriated through the state's stewardship program. Under the committee rules, a single member can anonymously block purchases of more than $250,000. As a practical matter, then, that means all land purchases. The case was argued by attorneys for the governor and the Joint Committee on Finance. The governor's attorney opened the argument with,
"May the legislative branch both make the law and then control its execution. Of course not. That is one of the primary threats to individual liberty against which our separation of powers guards. And the legislative vetoes at issue here today collapsed legislative and executive power in exactly that dangerous way, which is why courts nationwide have been virtually unanimous in rejecting them."
The court's conservative repeatedly asked the governor's attorney if curtailing the veto powers of Joint Finance would also curtail the veto powers of other committees, such as the Joint Committee on Rules. The governor's attorney said yes.
"We believe that the rules that we are asking this court to adopt will extend more broadly than the 2 legislative vetoes at issue here. This case does just challenge 2, but again, the rules we're adopting, I believe, will invalidate many, if not most, legislative committee vetoes that are on the books, yes."
They maintain the broad powers of the legislature are unusual when compared to other states. They say that all other state courts have rejected the ability of legislative committees to use a veto through appropriations.
"And that would effectively mean that a legislative veto could be used to control, I think, virtually everything that the executive branch does. And we know that simply cannot be correct. That is not the result that any other state courts have reached when considering this very issue. States across the country have recognized that this kind of veto over the core executive function of taking a statute that the legislature has passed and then applying it to individual circumstances is an executive function."
The attorney for the Joint Finance Committee argued that in Wisconsin, there are years of precedent that allow this to continue. He also stated that this would be a dramatic and revolutionary change and that we don't know the results. Justice Karofsky asked, "What are the limiting powers of the Joint Finance Committee?"
"Let me just go through a series of questions I have about this program specifically, okay? Like, could the Joint Committee on Finance hold a Knowles-Nelson proposal in abeyance in perpetuity?"
"It could deny it, or it could..."
"Forever, right? Right? And are they, is the Joint Committee on Finance, are they obligated to consider any statutorily recognized interest in land conservation when they do that?"
"They are not required, but I will..."
"And let me, I just want to ask a couple more questions, okay. And then you can rebut me for the rest of your time if you'd like. are they required to articulate a reason, any reasoning, or are they required to issue a decision when they exercise their veto power?
No.
Is it appealable or reviewable?
No.
So I don't understand what processes, what procedures, what policy determinations the Joint Committee on Finance needs to make in order to veto a proposal. I mean, there doesn't seem to me to be any limits whatsoever. There are zero guardrails here.
Attorneys from the UW Law School's Center for Democracy Initiatives filed a friend of the court brief that looked at what other state courts have found when answering this question. They say that joint finance effectively has established itself as a fourth branch of government, and further that its quorum rules have enormous power. Here's Justice Kurofsky again.
Starting on page 12 of their brief, just articulate over and over, you know, they say this is on page 12, that the legislature must maintain journals, keep its doors open to the public. A majority of the legislatures must be present to do business. The Joint Finance Committee consists of 16 people out of 132 who are in the legislature. 75% of those are from one party. They have a quorum with only five people, and it only takes one person to veto it.
Only four of the 16 members of the Joint Finance Committee are Democrats. During today's oral arguments, one conservative justice suggested that this is a very complicated question and that it might deserve further review. Here is Justice Ziegler with the governor's attorney responding.
Why rush this case as it's been
Because the
rushed.
JCF vetoes are imposing a significant burden on the executive branch. As we pointed out in our petition, one-third of Knowles Nelson projects over the past 5 years have been vetoed. This is a big problem today. We cannot wait for a decision.
A ruling is expected this summer. This is David Ahrens for WORT News.
Many news outlets and social media users are in a tizzy about a proposed arrest warrant for Kirk Bangstad. But a technicality in the court filing system is to blame for setting off the alarm. Reporter Sarah Gabler has the details.
No, Kirk Bangstad is not going to be arrested. Bangstad is the rabble-rousing liberal activist and owner of the Minocqua Brewing Company, which recently opened a tap room on East Washington Avenue in Madison. He also owes $750,000 in a defamation suit filed against him by the Lakeland Times newspaper and its owner Greg Walker for libelous posts Bangstad made on Facebook. This is the largest defamation settlement in Wisconsin history. Yesterday, news outlets and social media users started reporting that there was a warrant out for Bangstad's arrest. Speaking to WORT this morning, Bangstad says he heard about the warrant from his friends.
And all of a sudden, I find out through many friends of mine who check CCAP that there's a warrant issued for my arrest, which was very surprising and very humorous.
The warrant was filed by Walker's attorney, Matthew Fernholz, because Bangstad failed to attend a deposition hearing last Wednesday to go over his finances and ability to pay the court-ordered fine. Bangstad says he simply forgot he was scheduled for the deposition that day. However, when he realized the error, his lawyer immediately asked for the meeting to be held virtually, a request that Fernholz denied. According to Bangstad's lawyer, Fred Melms, who declined to be recorded for this broadcast, previous meetings have been held over Zoom with no issue. In response, Fernholz, who's Walker's attorney, filed a request for an arrest warrant against Bangstad. Brenda Burrell is the clerk of courts for Oneida County, where Bangstad was tried, and also declined to be recorded today. She tells WORT that when an attorney files an arrest warrant through the court's electronic system, the warrant is automatically processed as authorized by a judge. But in this case, the warrant was only proposed. That request has not been authorized by a judge because supplemental hearings, like the one Bangstad missed last week, are not overseen by a judge. Bangstad alleges that the warrant is a punitive measure by Fernholz, who could have simply accepted the virtual meeting request.
And my feeling is that he didn't want to do that because this is an opportunity for him to raise a big stink and potentially get a couple news stories out about me somehow being, outside of the law.
Melms agrees, saying that in civil and small claims cases, an arrest warrant is the, quote, nuclear, unquote, option. Typically, failure to attend a supplemental hearing is met with a fine or the meeting is rescheduled, says Melms. Not only is the warrant politically motivated, alleges Bangstad, but it has caused a lot of bad press.
No less than 4 news organizations went live with a headline, warrant issued for Bankstead's arrest. That was the ABC, NBC, CBS affiliate in Wausau and Rhinelander, and the Wausau Pilot and News Review.
The confusion lies with the way the warrant is filed on the Wisconsin Circuit Court Access website, referred to as CCAP. Bankstad describes why.
And that because there's not an actual button to click in CCAP for that type of warrant, it just went as a warrant for an arrest. But there's actually no warrant issued for my arrest. It was just a category that wasn't there in CCAP.
According to Melms, the court filing system isn't set up to report when arrest warrants are proposed by legal counsel because these situations are extremely rare. He added that it wouldn't be worth the state's time and money to fix because it's not likely to happen again. Clerk Burrell believes that the proposed arrest warrant will not be signed, but will instead be addressed at the next hearing in Bankstad's case, which is scheduled for May 23rd. As of this afternoon, a note has been added to the CCAP page saying that the warrant is, quote, proposed, unquote. But the damage has already been done, says Bankstad.
I thought I was a wanted man. I was like on the lam right now. And in actuality, there was never a warrant for an arrest. And 4 news organizations got it wrong and made my company and me look ridiculous.
Reporting for WORT News, I'm Sarah Gabler.
Conspiracy theories exploded in popularity after the election in 2020. And since then, election workers across the country have faced threats, vitriol, and even violence. This morning, 8 o'clock Buzz host Tony Castaneda took Dane County Clerk Scott McDonald's temperature on elections past and future.
Was the 2020 election run here in Wisconsin run fairly and with no fraudulent activity?
Yeah, no, that was a very clean election. I remember the election night, we were happy that it came off well. And so, of course, afterwards, we have a whole series of checklists that we use to make sure that the votes are counted properly and the only people who should be voting were voting. So, yeah, from our point of view, that went surprisingly well considering the circumstances.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I actually remember talking to people and they said actually it was one of the best run elections. Not only saying because given the circumstances, I mean, the circumstances were there was a national pandemic at the time. But even with that, the elections were some of the most well-run and efficient elections. And Donald Trump lost.
Yeah. I mean, in 2016, I mean, I was the one saying that Trump won and that the recount wasn't going to change the results. And the same was true in 2020. Trump lost and the recount wasn't going to change the results because of how accurate our systems are. And that was proven to be true both times.
Now, the threats to election officials have become an epidemic. They're calling it an epidemic, according to the executive director of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. Many people have quit, left their jobs, or, you know, just early retirement or whatever because of that. What about here in Dane County? Is that something you've seen? And also, maybe you might know what the city of Madison, too. Have we seen a lot of people say, forget it, I'm not dealing with this or what?
Yeah, we've seen it here. We've seen it around the state. I've seen several clerks that I've known for a long time leave early because they're getting followed around, followed to their car, threatened. And in Dane County, we're seeing it's harder to recruit people into these jobs. So we've had about a third of our clerks turnover, which is a little higher than normal. Statewide, it's the same. In Georgia, it was half of them turned over. So
really?
It's focused on the purple states, you know, the Michigan, Wisconsin, Georgia, Arizona, but it's actually happening everywhere. And it's a phenomenon that I'm not sure it's going to go away anytime soon.
Well, it may be obvious, but what does this really mean in terms of the ability to run free and fair elections?
Well, it's an effort to intimidate election officials into doing what you want them to do. So, you know, if they're like, for example, don't want people to vote absentee, or they want to try to skew some of the rules of the laws in their favor. And that was one of the interesting things, all the reviews that occurred of the 2020 election, no one actually was suggesting that people who were voting who couldn't legally vote. A lot of it was, well, they used a drop box. Okay, but whose ballot is in that drop box? Oh, well, they're all legal ballots, but we didn't like that it was in a drop box.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they're calling it harvesting, the event that was held at James Madison Park, right?
Yeah, the Democracy in the Park, I think it was referred to. So, yeah, but that was, again, that went to the Supreme Court. They had no issue with it, so...
When it comes down to it, these are legitimate voters, and they cast one vote.
Exactly.
And in whatever manner. So there were creative attempts, approaches to carrying out that election, which were deemed necessary because of the health crisis at the time. Now, to get a little bit closer to home here, security up for Wolf as Trump attacks rise. That's from a Milwaukee Journal article just a couple days ago. Donald Trump has actually specifically named Megan Wolf. She's the administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, of course. And that has a kind of forced Governor Evers to increase security for her. What about what's going on with Megan Wolf and the Wisconsin Elections Commission? And the fact that Robert Spindell, who was actually one of the accused of being and was proven to be one of the fake electors, that still sits on the Wisconsin Election Commission. I mean, who should be leaving, Robert Spindell or Megan Wolf?
Robert Spindell has no business being in charge of elections in any way. You know, I don't know how that guy walks free, honestly. But yeah, Megan Wolf is truly a hero in this whole story. They have tried everything they can think of to try to push her out so they could replace her with someone more to their liking. She has not caved to that. There have been threats against her for some time, well before this more recent Trump-specific attack on her, but that's what they're trying to do, ramp up the attacks. And what happens is people who are, you know, maybe have some personal issues or that's, you're worried that they're going to be activated to, you know, pursue or attack or do things because of their own mental health problems or whatever. That's what we worry about. She had, I think, multiple investigations of death threats against her before this.
Mm-hmm. And the thing about Megan Wolf, and of course, she's very principled in her job and what her responsibilities are. So, of course, she might want to reply to these accusations, but of course she can't. She says, I can't do that because then to these guys, and it's maybe what they're trying to do is they're going to try to say, see, she's partisan and she's taking sides. She says, I can't comment one way or the other than to say that she has full confidence in election officials around the state and in the many different jurisdictions that carry out the elections, and many of them are Republican. We should let people know, or they're dominated by people that might vote or lean Republican.
Mm-hmm.
But she is just sticking up for the whole process itself. Fortunately for you, since you're an elected official, you can actually make some partisan comments, right?
I mean, the thing to understand about Megan is the clerks, and you're correct, Republican clerks around the state are Democratic because the county clerks are partisan offices. Municipal clerks are nonpartisan, but they all support Megan. They are deeply appreciative that she's clearly decided she's hanging in here through the November election. She's going to make sure that this is run effectively, efficiently. You know, they're short-staffed over there. They've been denied money by this legislature, so they're doing the best they can on limited resources, and they're doing a good job. And we need them to do a good job. They are an incredibly important part of the whole system. And she's dedicated to making sure that that happens through this November.
The time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Marcus Slayton, here with co-host Christina Leffering. Thanks for joining us.
This week on The House Always Wins, carpentry instructors and kitchen cabinet origami masters John and Allie discuss whether ready-to-assemble cabinets are a good choice for do-it-yourselfers.
I call it housework, because it's light work.
What you
I'ma throw shapes, filling the base till my feet hurt.
Hey!
I call it housework.
Hello, I'm John.
And I'm Allie, and welcome to The House Always Wins, where you can learn cool stuff about your house.
We love cool stuff. Hey, Allie, I know we were working with some students lately on a job you were doing, and I noticed you tried something different for one time. I was wondering if we could maybe talk about that. You used ready-to-assemble cabinetry, and I'm curious what you thought of that and how that went, and if that's something that homeowners could consider doing themselves.
Yeah, sure. So RTA is typically how we abbreviate it.
Yep.
It's a kitchen job on a rental property. And so a couple options are before you when you do this. You can, probably one of the more expensive options is get a kitchen designer out there and buy completely assembled cabinets. The cabinets come as assembled units.
Right.
And so in some ways, simple.
Yeah, that's the way it always used to be. You'd go with a designer and they'd show up with full cabinets and you'd install them. But this is a new thing nowadays. Well, not that new.
Right. And then, you know, the sort of the other side of this is your IKEA type thing, which is you have to assemble them. They come flat, right?
Your Guten Morgen Schnorkel.
Yes, exactly. those, you know, you can walk into an IKEA with your dimensions and start clicking, and you can do this online for that matter, start clicking in the different cabinet sizes and sort of put it together. And, you know, the one big caution on that, right, is that you have to measure your kitchen.
Right.
Nobody's going to do that for you there.
Yes.
And so getting it right is important.
Yeah, and like where that window is in the wall.
Sure. Yeah. And there's definitely some pitfalls we should talk about. I haven't been in love with the quality of IKEA cabinets.
Agreed.
I think they've actually gone down in quality. They're made of particle board. I didn't want particle board. I prefer plywood cabinets. I did a little searching online, as you do, RTA cabinets. And I found a company, and they seemed like they had a few different lines available, sort of a lower quality, what they would call an apartment line. And I was like, you know what? That will make me miserable to deal with because
it's going
to
be particle board.
Everything is, well, it wasn't it was plywood, but it was like everything's put together a little more cheaply, a little more, it just feels like it's a little more held together by thoughts and prayers.
Thoughts and prayers.
And so I did order one of their slightly higher quality line, which costs more, of course. And it was kind of nice. Like they came flat packed. They came quickly. It took like 3 days from when I ordered them. I was just like, wait.
Wow.
It was like way too soon. But wow. There they were.
And we should be clear that if you go the old school line, you would wait months potentially.
Potentially, yeah.
Yeah.
Then pull them out of the package. They come with a set of instructions again. It's similar to IKEA.
Yeah. No words.
No words.
No words.
Only
oh
pictures.
My God.
I had students in my class assembling them actually. And for the most part, they did pretty well with it. I sort of did one on my own to sort of see what the process was so I could help the students out. Because I wouldn't have said like somebody brand new to it would have just figured it out based on the pictures.
Right.
I had some sense of how this should turn out.
Well, you happen to be a master cabinet maker, so that kind of makes sense to
me. Yeah, yeah. So, so with a little bit of guidance, though, the students generally, they were able to figure it out. And this was the first time that most of them had ever done this.
And that's a metric right there. If our students can put them together, hey.
Mm-hmm. And they're pretty decent quality. They look pretty good.
Yeah, I saw them. I agree. I was impressed. You know, plywood, the whole cabinet ring is made out of plywood. The face frames and everything seemed, the finishes were nice.
Yeah, they were all right.
That was a decent looking cabinet. And now, price point wise, you know, we're talking thousands of dollars less, right?
Yeah, I think it'd probably be, so I spend about $5,000 for 13 cabinets and then various accessories to go with it. And it was probably a couple, $3,000 more than an IKEA or their lower line would have been. So I thought it was pretty good. Not a bad deal. Same amount of cabinets already assembled with a kitchen designer involved, probably would have been closer to $10,000.
Yeah, easily double.
Easily no double. Doubt. So it felt like a pretty good compromise position between that and where I landed. And one thing I will say is the company sent me samples of the doors that I was interested in. They have a pretty good explanation of what exactly the cabinet was going to be, what kind of hardware was included, what, you know, the thickness of the plywood, all of that stuff. So I, knowing a bit about this stuff, I was able to be able to say, oh, okay, those drawers are going to open 100% of the full open drawers. They're going to have this kind of hardware, you know, so there was a benefit to having some pre-knowledge.
Right. So that's the thing is if you've never set a cabinet in your life, yeah, I don't know if that's really a great way to go. As you mentioned earlier, if you have some chops and you know your way around your power tools and you're willing to take it on, I would start small. Maybe start with a bathroom.
Yeah.
With like one or two cabinets, kind of learn your way how to put the cabinets together, how they go in. You know, there's scribe strips that you use to make them go up against the wall. And I definitely would not start with a complicated kitchen that has two windows in it and a fridge panel and dishwasher. That's next level stuff for sure. So I definitely wouldn't say everybody should take this on based on the ease of assembly of those ready to assemble cabinets. But it's something if you have some moxie and you have some skills, it's something you could consider.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think like some of the pitfalls that I think to be aware of is you always have to think about things like if you have drawers in a corner that they'll actually be able to open. So sometimes people get pretty attached to the idea that they're going to get as much cabinets in there as possible. And so they don't want to have any filler strips and things like that. And then you run into the situation. I've seen it.
Yep.
Where the drawer opens into the dishwasher or something like that. It's just you can't open a drawer.
And yeah, those inside corners are tricky and dangerous. And you got to be careful. Yeah. Or the hardware, people forget about adding the doorknobs. Mm-hmm. And they'll have drawers inside of both corners. And when they first put it in, it's like, yeah, they both open. And then you put hardware on and dink, the drawer doesn't open anymore. Yeah. So it's not, you do need to know your way around a kitchen somewhat in order to do this correctly. Otherwise, you can run into a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
But I know back, swinging it back though, the idea of so what you saw and what I agree I saw too is these ready to assemble cabinets that cost a lot less, but they're actually still pretty decent cases.
Yeah, they're absolutely, they're totally fine. I was generally impressed with their quality. There was one, they sent a refrigerator panel, which is usually a panel that goes between the refrigerator and the rest of the cabinets, and it should have a finished front, and it didn't. It was just a painted piece of plywood with nothing finished on the edge of the plywood, and I was like, what is this? What's going on? And so I was able to improvise, and then I called the company, and I was like, this is completely unacceptable to me, and, I'm not paying $300 for a piece of plywood that I have to finish myself.
Right.
And they were a really responsive company. The name of the company was Lillian Cabinets. So yeah.
And actually, that is a company that, in the research I've done as well, that is one of the better names out there.
Yeah, they were, at my first reach out to them, they were a little hesitant. And then when I pushed it and I said, I paid $300 for that panel and it was not a finished panel, then they were like, oh, well, what is it? What would satisfy you here? And I told them what would satisfy me, and it was in the mail within a week.
Wow, that's great. Along those lines, that's probably all we have time to talk about today. So on that note,
if you have any questions about carpentry or home improvement, then drop us an email at thehousealwayswins@wortfm.org. But I'm gonna throw shade if I don't get paid for this housework.
I call it housework. On this edition of Out of the Box, host D Star formerly inducts Milwaukee Alderman Khalif Rainey into the Milwaukee Hip Hop Museum. Rainey explains how he developed America's first hip-hop week and its three tenets: health, financial literacy, and civic engagement.
Wow. Look at this. Wow. That's amazing.
Khalif Rainey, for all your contribution to the hip-hop community here in Milwaukee.
Man, I appreciate that, man. Appreciate you. Thank you very much.
No problem.
Appreciate that.
You did it. You've done a lot. You continue to be of service, and we just really wanted to celebrate you.
I never got a hip-hop award, so this is my first time getting an award associated with hip-hop, so thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, and it's funny because you created the first hip-hop week in any city in America, so it's only right.
Thank you again. I appreciate it. You know, the idea of hip-hop week, I saw like fashion week. I saw restaurant week, so to me, I'm thinking like, no, duh, we need a hip hop week, right?
Right, right.
So when I said that, my wife was like, you got to make sense of it, though. Like, we just can't be out there spinning on our heads for a week. We have to actually make it a value to the community. So for me, beyond the hip hop, beyond the culture, beyond the art, hip hop week is really about creating a platform to bring members of the community together to get resources, information that they can improve their quality of life with. So we have a lot of fun. We enjoy the 7 days, but what's most importantly is connecting with people with the resources that they can change the quality of their life.
Absolutely. So kind of take me through its inception.
It really was as simple as I just mentioned. I saw a fashion week. That's something that the city supports. We have restaurant week where we highlight several other, restaurants in the city. And, I thought it was important that we celebrate the culture that was the most dominant culture in the world at that time, right? I believe it still is.
Still is.
So I'm thinking like, this is a good way to bring people together, especially in the community that's faced so many challenges. Bringing people together, bringing resources to the table and celebrating and having fun. So that really was the premise behind the idea. And, I've enjoyed every single hip hop week we've had. We had some very celebrated people come to the city and participate. And I hope we can continue that going forward.
What are some of the most memorable moments that you've had in Hip Hop Week?
I must say the first year when we had DJ Kool Herc. And, the one thing I must mention about Hip Hop Week was, when I actually introduced the idea, the Common Council, we passed the policy before I had even one act to come and perform for the Hip Hop Week. But once I mentioned it, once it was public, once it was in the papers and the news, so many partners from the city started contacting me saying, hey, we want to be a part of it. We want to participate. How can we be a part of it? So, it's something that the city has been behind, and it's a very diverse group of supporters. I got to thank Associated Bank. I got to thank Leslie and Joe at the Rave. I got to thank Matt Talbot. So many people who come together to make it happen. So, you know, I had the idea, but without the community support, you know, it wouldn't go anywhere.
Absolutely. So did you expect for the community to embrace it as much as they have?
Well, you know, knowing hip hop, like I know hip hop, you know, I anticipated that they would. I anticipated that this is something that they would want, knowing that, you know, we lost African World Festival and we lost some of the community activities that we celebrated over the years.
Why is that? What happened? Because I know that was like the biggest one in the country, right? The African Fest?
African World Festival.
Yeah. What happened with that?
Well, I'm actually a former board member of African World Festival. I was a part of the team that bought it back. You know, after it went defunct for a while, we bought Charlie Wilson and others to celebrate African World Festival. But
shout out to Charlie Wilson.
Shout out to Charlie Wilson.
I love Charlie Wilson.
How can you not? Man. You know, but what one of the challenges was, and the thing that I'm trying to avoid with Hip Hop Week, is there was an act of violence that occurred at African World Festival, and that kind of sent it into a tailspin. So, you know, I kind of designed Hip Hop Week with that in mind. Like, yeah, I know that rap battles are part of hip hop, but I try to avoid things that could mar, you know, the image that Hip Hop Week has here in the city of Milwaukee and keep it positive.
Absolutely. So you're using hip hop in such a unique way. So you're using hip hop as a catalyst to bring in the youth and to bring in their parents and give them information, education, and resources. What gave you the idea to mix the two?
Excuse me. Well, you know, in my role as an alderman, I'm really just doing my job. You know, my job is to connect my constituents, the people, the residents of the city of Milwaukee with resources. That's my goals. So this is the way that I figured that I can serve some of my constituents. I represent like 53206. I represent probably one of the most African-American districts in the city of Milwaukee. And knowing the affinity that we have for hip hop. So you say, you know, it's young people up to their father. So the three tenets of Hip Hop Week are health, financial literacy, and civic engagement. Right. So we talk about finances and hip hop. We talk about getting our money. Right. Let's really explore that, though. Let's really talk about how do we create a pattern of healthy spending and saving? Like, what are some of the opportunities for us to be entrepreneurs? So during Hip Hop Week, we really dig into that. This past Hip Hop Week, we had Dame Dash, and he talked about, you know, what he experienced with being an entrepreneurship and some of the things, you know, that could catapult us or could possibly be our downfall. You know, when we talk about health, you know, we had the likes of like Master Ace. Shout out Master Ace. He suffers from MS, you know, so we talked about the things that he do to live a healthy lifestyle, how he avoids certain things and how he maintains his health. So when you talk about, you know, young people up to adults, that's a different conversation, right? We could talk about your sexual health to young people or talk about avoiding drugs and things of that nature. Now to your father, we could talk about prostate cancer. We could talk about et cetera, high blood pressure, whatever. So it goes from one extreme to the other. We could talk to young people, to old people, and we could still talk in the same context, which is hip hop.
So you said the
civic engagement.
Civic engagement. Yep. I'm sorry. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
When we talk about civic engagement, that's essentially what we're just talking about before we started this conversation on air. We're talking about people voting, getting involved in their community. How do you do that? What that look like, right? So we had the likes of like Stickman from Dead Prez. Mm. He's come and he's talked about being civically involved. We had Scarface from Houston, who at the time was running for office, running for the Common Council in the city of Houston. And he came and shared why he was running for office and what that meant in the sense of hip hop. Right. And we had a good conversation. But yeah, we touching those things, you know, health, financial literacy and getting people involved in their community.
What are some of the things that you really hope for the future for Hip Hop Week?
You know, some of the things that I hope to do that I haven't done yet for Hip Hop Week. You know, I was talking to a photographer by the name of Jonathan Mannion. He's shot some of the most epic hip hop photos in the history of hip hop. You know, I want to work with the art museum and have an exhibit there where I really want to introduce the community at large to different aspects of hip hop. Like, I'm pretty sure people wouldn't even know there's a photography aspect to that.
Right.
There's a film aspect.
Like
to that.
Cartoon.
Absolutely.
Yeah, cartoon. And when you're talking about artistry, like, you know, tattoos,
right?
You know,
graffiti, absolutely,
yeah, things like that.
So I think it's an opportunity for those who love hip hop and, you know, have an affinity for it. They can come enjoy some of those things in their own community, and then I also think it's an opportunity for people who may not know much about hip hop and what it's about to come experience it in a capacity that they're not accustomed to, and find a new appreciation for it.
That was D-Star speaking with Milwaukee Alderman Khalif Rainey. You can listen to the rest of their conversation on the Out of the Box podcast.
David Well is this year's recipient of the 2024 Wisconsin Visual Art Achievement Award for Community Arts Advocacy. He is also the gallery director at Edgewood College, the home of nearly 130 sculptures and paintings by Mona Webb. Webb was born in 1914 and, after traveling the world for many years, put down roots in Madison. Until her death in 1998, she was known as the Goddess of Willie Street. In this archival edition of Radio Chipstone, David Well and feature contributor Jennifer Fields interpret some of Webb's works.
We are looking at work that celebrates, I would say, the goddess as a spiritual idea manifested through objects and through painting. But I think the sculptural work particularly speaks more to imaging of her goddess idea.
And when you look at them, particularly this piece, it's metal. It's on what looks to be a painted stump.
Yes, it's wood, a piece of a stump. There's leather, there's metal, there's stones. You have a sense of altar figure. You have a sense of almost a spinning universe around it in the way that the wire is put together and moves.
And the bones of the universe, if you want to call it that, the bones of the universe are pipes.
Mm-hmm, are pipes, copper pipes.
Looks like found pendants.
They could be found, or they could have been things that she did, because they all have the same top. So that I think that they could be handmade working with that and with the materials that she collected, because I think she was very particular about her stones. So these stones would have to have some particular feeling or meaning for her to be involved in this sculpture.
I think one of the things that people think about, or one of the things that pops into people's minds when they think about found objects or object art or self-taught art, is that there are things that are bits and pieces that are collected that are then put as part of a collage as is. But she's definitely done some sort of manipulation with them before she's added them to the piece.
I would say, from my familiarity with a lot of self-taught artists, is that seldom are the pieces used just as is. They are almost always manipulated in some sort. There is energy put into them so that there's more energy coming out of them. Because usually in this type of work, the people are really interested in the energy of the world, the energy of the universe, the energy of the soul. I'm making some generalizations, but I think that the investment of your material with that energy so that it gives energy back is very important to the artist and to the work.
And I think that another misconception is that there's no rhyme or reason to that energy, but it's a particular message and a particular mode of expressing that energy, not this energy is coming through me and it's telling me what to do.
Well, I think particularly in the work that we have, you can really see the message of empowering the female, empowering the goddess. The goddess is embodied in every woman, and Mona was very much about trying to support and encourage other people to realize that power. The other thing that I think is that she had lived in a number of different places and had collected things representing cultures around the world. I mean, she had been in Tahiti in the 50s, so she was not unworldly and was very familiar with multiple cultures. And so her work really represents a lot of that, too. I think in this figure here, you can see a figure that could be African, it could be from India, it could be from a lot of different cultures, all of which are goddess, you know, it's a goddess image.
And it's a completely different material. What material is this?
This is alabaster. So a soft stone. It was one of her favorite materials to work in. So there are a number of pieces that we have that are all carved stone. One of my favorites is this small one right over here. that I think is really quite wonderful. So you have a figure that is a kneeling figure with pendulous breasts, with fists held about the waist underneath those breasts, and an image that, a facial image that is just very determined, that's mask-like but determined. And the whole thing has this aura of just determination, we will persevere.
Her work mirrors the fact that we are more complicated beings mm-hmm. than what people may think, mm-hmm. that there are many parts to us. In her work, you can sort of see all of her travels and all of her ideas and sort of that swirly sort of heady time on Willie Street during those days where mm-hmm. it was international in a sense, mm-hmm. but it was also this butting up against this very practical Wisconsin sort of salt in your bones.
And there was also a Hawaiian influence, because her husband, Mr. Webb, was younger, was a student here in, I think, botany or something, and that's how they met, but bonded over an understanding of sort of kahuna culture, if you will, from Hawaii, and that kind of embodiment of this rich spiritual principle that was a shared thing. And I know that she referred to the kahuna frequently, is from what I understand. That shared power of female goddess is really one of the things that I would say, both and also that is beyond just saying goddess, that means sexuality, that means motherhood, that means all of those things, because her many of her paintings are about women and their children and giving birth, and just that idea that you carry with you constantly this generative principle.
Is this someone who is telling you who they are, or are they telling you what they've experienced and what they've seen? If that makes any sense.
I don't believe that it's work being made about what they've seen. I don't believe it's work that's about trying to tell a story, that's about trying to give us a narrative about herself. I think it's very much work that's being made in the moment of working to deepen a personal spiritual understanding. I think that you see a sense of myth, you see a sense of shared universal stories in all of these pieces. You don't, which I think is about the artist participating in the universal and speaking about that universal and trying to make other people understand. It's like, look, this is what it's about. So that's what I'm making work about. And so I think the work is being made about an understanding of principles that might not be more easily expressed in any other way.
For WORT, I'm Jennifer Fields.
That was Jennifer Fields and David Well, the gallery director at Edgewood Community College, on The Goddess of Willie Street.
And that's a wrap for WORT's Live Local News at 6. Russ Mackey was your headline writer. Your reporters tonight were David Ahrens and Sarah Gabler. Special thanks to feature contributors D. Star, John Stephanie and Ali Barini, and Jennifer Fields. Katie Jurgella engineered the show. Faye Parks produced this newscast. And Ms. Shali Pittman is the news director here at WORT. Thank you guys for listening. I'm your host, Marcus Sleet.
And I'm Christina Leffering. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is the Perpetual Notion Machine. Have a good night.